Hello, and welcome to the End of Seeking podcast, episode 18. With me, Imogen, and Martin.
Hello. So every time we come to these podcasts, well, not every time, but often when we come to these podcasts, we come with an idea of, if not a theme, a jumping off point.
Yeah, and it's often something we've just... like
just been talking about
half an hour ago been talking about, so it's not, it's lively, it's relevant, it's fresh.
Yeah, we can't plan ahead too much. There is a list of things that in the fullness of time I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah,
because there's so much to touch on in this field of inquiry. This week something came up that's quite interesting to us both, and it's the relevance of breakdown in personal one's personal experience on the spiritual path. Actually, often that breakdown precedes an awakening.
Yeah,
a crisis is a sign, in a sense, that the structures and presumptions that constitute one's life can fall apart as a prelude to what's beyond that, an order that's beyond that.
Yeah, and it is also, it is sort of necessary. Now, whether that is a full-on breakdown or not is, you know, for some it is, for others it isn't. But it's the sort of the destructive process of the structures in place, the held beliefs, the concepts.
Yeah, the sense of who and what you are and what is the nature of the reality you seem to be inhabiting.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm trying to say is it doesn't have to be a harrowing experience for all, but for some it is.
And I think what brought this up, actually, was not quite yet on, we were talking not entirely on the personal level, but we were just observing
the collective, the culture,
the society at the moment, the global culture at the moment. And it seems to be everyone's pulling in different directions. There's a breakdown of a sense that of the old order.
Yeah, of the old structures in place.
The old order.
The ways of thinking, the ways of moving in the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, this can be seen in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of levels. I mean, we see that in nature. We see, you know, the breakdown in autumn, winter, that there it is there. And then the renewal and the rebirth that comes in the spring and summer.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels to me very obvious that you can see this process mirrored and experienced in so many different manners.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, one of the things that came to mind was a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, which is where Krishna is talking about how and why he incarnates, why the divine comes into the world. Now, let's just be clear here. We're not necessarily talking literally, although maybe it is. Maybe it's true on all levels, or maybe it's untrue on all levels. Either way, it's indicating a certain process, which I found to be quite evocative. And so the verse goes something like...
This is at the end of the Bhagavad Gita.
It's in the midst. Okay, I mean, it's in the midst of it where... So the Gita is emerges in the Mahabharata, probably towards the end. It's this piece of this self-contained book in the midst of a very large epic, and you know it maps the conflict, the progressive breakdown of order in an ancient kingdom between two sets of brothers and the families and whatnot. And, you know, the Bhagavad Gita is finally the piece where war has come about. You know, things have broken down to such an extent that there's war open war, and there are two armies, you know, nominally good and evil, standing against each other. But on each side, there are good and bad people, you know. But so they faced up. So life has broken down. You know, the social order has broken down. And Krishna takes this opportunity to give a discourse to Arjuna, who's the great hero of it, and says, it talks about, he knows himself to be God, and Arjuna recognizes him as such within the story. But what the verse goes, something like, whenever Dharma is in decay and Adharma flourishes, so that's to say whenever order is breaking down, whenever, you know, the true way of things, the right way is breaking down, and whenever, like, Adharma, the negativity and disorder is flourishing, then I take a body, then I come, so that I can protect the righteous and destroy the wicked. So that's why he's there. And that's why he's there at that time. You know, he comes there because social order is breaking down, and he, as the divine principle incarnate, wants to establish the proper order, dharma.
What's this thing of, like, when everything's good, why?
Yeah, why bother? Yeah.
It's all good. So
it seems to be that the principle he's articulating is, at crisis, I'll be there.
Yeah.
Which I find is really quite interesting. Because if we take this as a personal allegory, as let's say that the whole of the story of the Gita as a way of telling the story of our own individual movement towards awakening, I like that principle. So the principle is saying that, taken personally, that when we're falling apart egoically, when our world as an individual is collapsing, is heading towards crisis, when order and when goodness, when well-being is just gone, and when all the negatives flourish, when all the wrong choices and all the wrong things are being made, when our world is falling apart, it's at that point of crisis that the divine, that the truth manifests itself, shows itself, mm-hmm. just as it, when you're at the bottom. And it, in talking and thinking about this, we've been reflecting on, it shows up, this principle shows up everywhere, mm-hmm. in our experience personally, in our observations of other people, but also in the mythic stories, in the scriptural stories, in literature, everywhere. This idea that breakdown needs to happen and happens, and then at the point of maximum crisis, the principle of order renews itself and brings itself forth.
The truth will be revealed.
Yeah, but it's at this point of great breakdown and crisis. Yeah.
It reminds me of that Rumi quote.
Go.
The wound is the place where the light enters you.
Right, right.
To me, that's what's being spoken of.
The cracking open. I mean, you talk about that a lot in your teaching and your work.
I mean, I've seen it in my own self, in my own journey. And I've seen it in close friends and family, and I've seen it in people I work with as well, where those moments of what to our current society seem like great vulnerabilities, those moments of great vulnerability, those moments of breakdown, those moments of crisis, we see those as weakness. We see those moments as something we need to get away from, and we've got to, move through them and get back to where we were,
or maintain the status quo. You don't back let to that, yourself break down, and what needs to be broken down.
And yet, what I see in people when there is that falling apart that happens, and it's held within the context that this isn't a mistake. Even though it feels really horrible often in the experience of it, that actually it is those moments that we find the bedrock, the nature of ourself, the nature of reality. It's those moments where our light starts to shine through, where we go, okay, what is essentially here? Because everything else I can't rely on. Everything is braised. You know, you see people trying to gather back all these cracks.
Hold it together.
Yeah, it's like the visual I get is an eggshell that's cracked into a million pieces.
Humpty Dumpty.
Yeah, and we're trying to put it all back together again. And instead of when you have the context of recognizing that this isn't a bad thing, this is actually a really wonderful thing.
Albeit can be tremendously challenging.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the context is what makes it less challenging. Yeah. It doesn't mean it's not challenging. It means it's less challenging. Why it's less challenging? Because we see that actually what is breaking apart is not me. It's not fundamentally that which I am cannot be broken. And so when seen in that light, it's almost like a welcoming starts to take over. Yeah. A welcoming of that brokenness starts to take over in the heart. And the divine is seen.
Yeah.
You are seen. Your true divine nature is seen.
I mean, I guess it points to this thing, so taking that principle that, you know, when things break down fully, then the divine, the truth shows itself, reveals itself personally, societally.
Yeah, a rebirth can happen.
A rebirth. I mean, that touches on we're looking at where this principle's shown in various, you know, mythic stories. I mean, the phoenix is a great example where, you know, it is the utter destruction of the phoenix in the fire, complete destruction, that then from those ashes, the phoenix rises again.
Yeah.
The hero's journey talks about, you know, the emergence of the hero in the hero's journey is a response to the status quo, which is the calcification of the order. The order. Yep. So you have this situation where old structures are held in place. And they need to renew, but they're not allowed to. It's the dragon that holds it all together. And so you end up with tyrannical governments, for example. That's what happens in this. But then, in some sense, the hero will go forth and, you know, have to shatter that state. It comes forth as a response to that, for that calcified and unnatural status quo. And then the status quo collapses and a new one's established in the wake of it.
You know, it reminds me of, we had a conversation, this must be about a year ago now, and it became really clear these cycles in my own life. And I remember us having this conversation about it because, you know, I'm getting quite personal here, but, you know, all in the name of a good exploration.
Yeah, yeah.
My life has been a sequence of this sort of burning down of structures into utter vulnerability, utter broken openness, and the rebirth that has come after that.
Yeah.
And why I remember the conversation with you is because there was this point where you really got that. You'd seen it, but you really got it, because there was a certain amount of trying to piece me back together because pain
of breaking
watching.
Down. It's very hard to watch. You go, what do you do here?
One. Yeah, so hard to watch.
No, I've had to learn to let you trust that you're going into this sort of phoenix mode.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, and it does look, and they're happening less and less, I would say, but they do happen, whereby there's some old structures that are needing to be burned to the ground. And it's not for me, it's a sort of an all or nothing kind of thing. I don't do things by half generally. So it's that process, and I've learned to really love and welcome that process now. But it sort of sheds you, like going through that process, it sheds all sense of knowingness. It's like everything you thought you knew is like completely destroyed. And if you think in that process you should be knowing something, there's great suffering then in terms of like trying to clamber back out into knowingness. But actually what I've learned is actually just sinking into that even further, into that destructive process, and seeing that that is absolutely how the phoenix rises. There's a certain amount of welcoming that then takes over, and trust of the process.
And I think it just, it's an observation of the principles of breakdown leading to breakthrough. And that's necessary. And, you know, in spiritual awakening, it's very hard. I mean, going through it, you know, seeing everything that you thought held to be true, valuable, everything you identified with, everything you hoped for, to be just completely broken down, gone, crisis. And, you know, it reveals where one is attached, for one, because attachment itself, trying to hold on to something that is, even if it's not true or not useful.
It's falsities.
That's false, but it's comforting.
Yeah, there's the thing. You know. It's comforting. It's better to hold on to something we know than let go into the unknown. And there's where the mind lives, is like in its known sense. It's like it lives for love,
whether
for knowing
it's true
this.
Or not. Yes. You know, let's hold on to this thing that is a comforting idea or a comforting identity or a comforting.
Yeah.
But it, you know,
even if it's giving me great suffering, even if that idea and that belief is causing great suffering in the longer term of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Adyashanti's phrase comes to mind: let go or be dragged. Because at a certain point, you know, you're going to, life is doing this. Like you were just talking about your own process where on intermittently one, you'll go through that experience of breaking down anything that sort of maybe have accumulated that's not serving or something like that.
Yeah.
To be fair, this can be very subtle as well. Yes. You know, the subtle accumulation of something or transformation requires the sacrifice of what isn't. You know, requires like a, you know, what's death to a caterpillar is new life to a butterfly. And so knowing that, you know, the poor caterpillar doesn't know on some level that he's going to be a butterfly. Knowing that this, but you can't know. I mean, that's the thing. Talk about using that as a metaphor for spiritual awakening. That's part of the problem, is that if you're approaching what seems to be death, egoically anyway, that can be really terrifying. And there's a lot I've written about this, the threshold of fear that stops you from going forward.
That leap of faith. It is a leap of faith at that point.
Yeah. And that fear can, when it arises, because all the ego sees as its own demise past that point, awakening is the death of the ego, let's say.
Because you're going to beyond the realms beyond the mind. The mind can't comprehend the possibility of how life is going to work without it at the center of existence.
Exactly. So, you know, the ego is still holding onto itself, right? And it sees the fear of that unknown and it projects into that void of unknowing and uses those projections as a reason to withdraw from breaking through.
Yeah.
From going forth, to go through the crisis rather than to just try to wheel backwards and avoid the crisis. Yeah. The crisis is
death.
Part of it. Yeah, crisis, but it's part of the process. The breakdown is the necessary precursor for the renewal from the deepest part of ourselves and the discovery of, what's beyond all this stuff that's breaking down? I still am. I am.
And what is beyond life and death?
Yes, the deathless, the birthless, the primordial being that we are. Yeah. But, you know, if your only identification is ego, and I don't mean ego, it is ego, but personal self, the self-image. And I see, you know, one sees it approaching that. Someone who's even very earnest in their desire to be free of their limiting view, of their narrow identifications. There's only through, I think it was, I don't know, Jung or Nietzsche or something. One of those guys was, you know, the only way to heaven is through hell.
Yeah.
You have to traverse it. You have to get through it.
Yeah, you can't go around.
No.
Because going around suggests the ego gets to stay intact, that's not what awakening is. It's not that the ego has to literally die, but there is something that comes in, a recognition that comes in that supersedes the ego, that opens up in a deeper ground that includes the ego. And that's what I mean. It doesn't have to die per se. It's just the ego as the seat of the self is what dies.
Exactly.
And
the discovery of the true self,
opens up. And so, but to an ego, all it sees, because all it knows is itself, all it sees is extinction.
And the ego, of course, is predicated on a bunch of unsustainable relative constructions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ego by nature doesn't exist as an independent entity, but it's a sort of an amalgam of ideas, perceptions, perspectives that seem to constitute. But there's this intrinsic knowing that the ego isn't me and could never be a permanent self, and certainly not a source of lasting happiness, no matter how one bolsters it. And so at some point that the true nature is actually always present.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of watching the ego fail at a certain point, the unsustainable nature of that bolstering and that ongoing constructing of holding together something that's untenable. You know, the self is sort of waiting for that to happen, and, you know, watching compassionately, in a sense, from our deepest part of ourselves. And so even though in a linear sense, oh, the ego's experiencing its own breakdown, and that's terrifying, and then the crisis is coming about despite itself, and then reveals the self.
Yeah,
you know, as
the light is found in that process.
That light is always, you know, this thing that is beyond, this nature beyond the ego, is always present.
Yeah, and is found through that process. It's like it's not.
Yeah.
It's not in spite of that process. It's because of that process that light, that truth is found.
Yes.
Because without that process, that light is hidden to itself.
Yes.
And so,
even though ironically it's always on, you know, that's the thing.
Yes.
It's the cognizance of it.
Yes.
It's the self knowing the self. Yeah. That's missed. Yeah. I like, there's a quote that says something like, all we need to know is how to let go of those things that are no longer serving us. Oh no, how gracefully we let go of those things that no longer serve us. But that's it. And that touches back onto this idea that I really like is the necessity of sacrifice to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
To allow that, whatever that is, it might be an attachment of one's way of living, way of operating, or an identity, a worldview.
Yeah. An image, a set of beliefs.
Yeah.
And often those set of beliefs inform the people we're around. So it can be also a letting go of community. And or certain ways of interacting with the world.
Well, you know, sacrifice shows up. This comes up in this conversation particularly because in talking about this necessary breakdown, one of the examples of it that shows up is drug addicts and alcoholics and whatnot, and this idea that in some sense, one isn't, if one is in the throes of an addictive life, then if life is working all right, if you're like a functional alcoholic or something, there's a lot of them around and life doesn't seem to be breaking down. You can function, you can just about keep down a job. You might have a functional
Well, one could argue we are all functionally addicts.
Yes,
to the mind.
To some people, yes, exactly. So, but I'm using that as an example of that trope, but it's probably a truism that you need to hit rock bottom somehow. I'm not sure how true that is, but if it feels that in order for the mind to change and go, in order to change, like what might be a low level destructive but seemingly sustainable, manageable, yeah, exactly, habit, in order for that to really, really change, to have that metanoia, you know, the Bible talks about, you know, the change of heart, the change of mind, the turning around of one's perspective, you need to hit rock bottom. You need to see that this isn't working. You have to kind of get to that crisis.
The cracks have to begin to show.
Often in a big way, and there you go, this isn't working, this isn't sustainable. And if you get through that crisis then a new way can come from that.
Yeah. And so, you know, of course we don't wish those crises upon ourselves or anyone, but in the same breath, I also want to say that for me, those crises are grace.
Yes.
They are grace of life revealing those cracks and the light that shines through those cracks if we care to take a look.
It's like that notion of Kali as a symbol of the process of awakening, whereby she... The image of Kali as this multi-armed, fierce goddess who was called into being to destroy all the demons that were plaguing reality. And she's, you know, she's adorned with a necklace of skulls, and there's blood, and her tongue's red out, and there's, you know, this big scythe, and it's just absolutely, yeah, absolutely fierce.
Scary,
yeah. Image. But we have to realize what's the symbolism there, and what's the nature. Who are the skulls? The skulls are the defeated demons, egoic, you know, tendencies and vices and all these things that, you know, they're the things that we need to conquer in order to,
misheld beliefs. And
so only that which is being destroyed are the demons of the egoic, you know, worldview.
And this is fierce grace. It's fierce grace. I would say a lot of people who walk through the awakening process would probably agree that there are points where you hit into fierce grace.
Yeah. And
always.
And that principle of the divine showing up as an uncompromisingly, seemingly destructive force of nature.
But that's what it takes.
Dispense with the delusion.
Yeah, exactly.
And the illusions and the.
Because they're comfortable delusions and illusions.
Yeah.
They feel nice. And so.
For a while.
Yeah, exactly. They, again, it's that sort of manageable, low level sense of okayness, but not really okayness, that sort of low level suffering. And so it's hard to get beyond some of that stuff sometimes because it is low level, because it is sort of marginally, it sort of works out for a while.
Yeah.
And you know, so there is a fierceness that sometimes really does have
to cut through. I mean, she's in some sense, Kali, we talked about a little bit before, but as a kind of the embodiment of a certain kind of uncompromising act of love, actually, because she's destroying that which is false, that which is actually destructive to our true nature.
So it doesn't look like
nature can be touched by any of this, but it is obscured by.
Yeah, it doesn't look like love on the surface level of it, but it is it is true and uncompromising in its love, actually, because it doesn't leave anything that is untrue.
No. So this need to destroy, let's say, or to break down in order to for the next renewed
birth
to occur, you have to, like, the seed, the birth of the sprout is the death of the seed. It's this necessity for, we talk about crisis, we talk about breakdown, we can talk about in terms of sacrifice, that what has to go in order for the next thing to arise. And from the perspective of the thing that's being destroyed, it's death.
Yeah.
And it's death. It's
devastating.
It's devastating. So if you're a person who finds oneself in crisis, a spiritual crisis, which can be, show up as a crisis of life, of meaning, of relationship,
of confidence, of image,
of things like occupation. And
financial.
The old world, all of it. It's two ways. You let go or be dragged. One of the, you can either go, try to hold it all together, do a Humpty Dumpty. This is the grace. This is life. Life is the grace. Life is creating the crisis. Life is saying, nope, no more. This isn't sustainable.
This isn't
your happiness truly. Because no matter how effectively you manage one's happiness on the level of the, let's say, the senses, or on the level of relativity, because of the constant changing, it's an effort.
Yeah.
I mean, you forget, ego isn't just a thing. An ego is an effort. Holding together, continuing to bolster the ego is a necessity. Continuing to seek happiness in passing phenomena. If your happiness is dependent, or your peace, happiness, whatever, your sense of
lack of suffering,
it is dependent upon things that pass. Mm-hmm. You've constantly got to go to the next thing that's passing, the next thing. You're daisy chaining peak experiences or happy events, passing happy events in order to. And if your identity is predicated on things that are transient, then your identity is always going to be vulnerable.
It's like trying to swim in a choppy waters with your head above water, and it's exhausting.
You're constantly treading water.
There's only so long.
So even if you kind of think you got that figured out, and you can go a long time, and a lot of people go their whole lifetime, managing this.
Yeah. But if those cracks have begun to show, so for most people, those cracks are so minor that they wouldn't necessarily notice them. They get a bit of polyfiller and they cover it over again put their Humpty Dumpty back together. Yeah. But if those cracks, and life has orchestrated those cracks to be sufficiently
unsustainable,
deep, let's say, it's like the light of life, that grace is pushing through those cracks and breaking it open. If that has happened to you in your life, this is where the phrase of let go or be dragged comes in, because it's like, let go, open up, let life fall apart.
Well,
and
we need
find what is underneath all of this falling apart.
And a word that comes to mind as well, which is really important, is rest. We need to come to a rest. This endless maintenance of ego and identity and pleasure seeking and all that. We want to be without effort, without having to maintain a structure, without having to seek. I mean, this is where seeking is. What are we seeking? We're just seeking that which we don't think we have. We're only going to be at peace when we can rest in the present moment. Rest, feeling I don't need to add anything to myself. I don't need to find or take anything away. I don't need to seek anything out. I simply am.
Yeah.
And that is found to be, that's the beauty of all this, that we find that when we do rest, oh, I am complete, I am sufficient, I am not broken. Yes, there's brokenness as an expression that arises and falls in life, in the relative life, sure, but that's okay because I am.
That is part of me too.
Yeah.
That brokenness even.
Yeah. And so discovering the deeper ground, the true nature, allows oneself to finally rest. But it's ironic because you can come at the, you know, you could say this from both ends, say finding your deep nature allows you to rest. But you can also say taking deep rest reveals true nature.
Yeah.
It's, but it, whichever way one comes to it, it's restful.
Yeah, it's to be in harmony and in flow with life. Mm. The natural flow of life is to be in a sort of repose with life, rather than a fight or a management or a keeping one's head above water with life.
Yeah.
It is to become life, actually.
Yeah.
It is to empty oneself.
To discover one is.
Yes, it's that, to empty oneself of those personal views of separation that I am not this. And to sink into the recognition of I am this too. This too I am.
Yeah. Yeah. What does that Gangaji say? You know, give up the something like, give up, actually Papaji and Gangaji for that matter, the message, give up the fight. Give up the seeking. Just stop.
Yeah.
Stop strategizing. Stop trying.
You will discover that which is never trying, never needing, never wanting.
Yeah. Yeah, seeking is exhausting.
It is absolutely
exhausting. And, you know, whether we're talking about spiritual seeking, which is a relatively late stage of the personal journey, most people aren't even aware of the possibility that there's a peace, there's a happiness, there's a rest that needs no effort, no finding, no maintenance.
No.
And so we chase it around. And the idea that you could, yes, exactly, causeless joy, causeless peace. I think in spiritual seeking, what differentiates it from just the sort of MO of normal egoic living, what separates spiritual seeking is that the suspicion, the intuition that there could be a lasting
often
peace.
It's preceded by a glimpse of that, right. A sense of that,
right.
An intuitive knowingness of that is recognized.
Yeah. And often that comes in crisis.
Yeah.
Not always. Sometimes, you know, we're...
Yeah, because in crisis you can't help, even if it's not conscious, but you can't help but see that which isn't in crisis somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, it throws into...
Because everything, you can't rely on anything. Well, what can I rely on?
Yeah.
And again, this might not be a conscious...
What's a deeper truth?
Yeah,
what's
this might not
reality?
Be a conscious process at the time. But it's like if your life is completely falling apart, if you're in total crisis and everything you thought you knew is no longer, there is still an essential you-ness that is there.
Well, this is it, isn't it?
An
this
always is... on-ness, a spark of life, you know, that principle of those that are in their 70s feeling like they're still in their 20s. We were just talking about this.
Yeah, that same ageless being, spirit consciousness is looking through the eyes of same knowing consciousness, looking through these eyes as did when I was a baby and as I will when I'm a, you know, when I'm an old fella. It's just timeless, it's ageless.
Yeah.
I liked years ago, I remember when we were in the TM, when I was in the TM movement, you were too. But this was before we met.
Yeah.
They like to do these celebrations and the Vedic celebrations often. You know, there's a big Vedic calendar, and I love that about the Indian Vedic way is that the calendar is always related to something, and there's all these wonderful days of celebrate this, celebrate that, and all this. And I love that, actually. I wish we had more days of remembrance of some aspect of reality, you know, remembrance, remember the divine, remember this aspect. So this day was, I can't remember the Sanskrit for it, but it was the day of victory.
Akshaya
Tritiya. Oh, Akshaya Tritiya? Yeah, it could be. Oh, no, is that the day of lasting achievements?
Oh, yes,
or
is, you're right. Oh,
anyway,
right.
There's, anyway, again, yeah, great. You know, yeah. These are great. I love this. You know, it just takes you out of your mundanity and brings you, celebrates collectively some bigger principle.
I used to really rail against those things, but yeah, actually, but now I just see it as a, like a life, yeah, throwing up remembrance of these things.
It's funny, you know, if you travel to India, my experience was that on any given day, there's something going on. There's some, like, you know, some parade and there's some celebration. I go, what's going on? Oh, it's this day. And, you know, the elephants, you know, adorned with, you know, bright colors and beautiful conches being blown and all that. Beautiful. And you know, this, the celebration of the spiritual reality. So this day of victory, I remember Maharishi talking about it, and he would say, why is it day of, you know, in this sort of his inimical way, why is it day of victory? Because the victory has already been won and already is already in place, however it seems, because life is divine.
Mm.
Whether you see it or not, life is divine, life is spirit. And so the victory of that reality is ever present.
Mm.
And I love that, whether we see it or not, underneath all our
ideas of life
and our sense of that crisis, this is part of why this idea of breakdown and crisis is so important, that don't worry about it, because underneath and beyond and prior to and even the crisis and breakdown itself, it's divine. It's meant to be. Mm-hmm. It is yielding to something more, something boundless that contains the crisis but isn't wrapped up in the crisis.
But the problem with the ego is it projects just more into, quotes, hell, more into,
yes, that it's hell all the way down.
And then there's the fear, is it because the ego can't imagine that there is something beyond itself, it projects is further darkness.
Exactly. And that's the nihilistic view. Better to hold it together, because the other direction is hell. And I like, and that's why the Gita, the Krishna saying, at the point of greatest crisis, actually war. I'm here because it's broken down. And when you're in total breakdown, then I, as the divine principle, will show myself.
Yeah.
It was always there, but I'm going to turn up for that. And so that's why he's an alcoholic and having the worst day of his life, breaking down. Maybe he goes, oh, there's light, there's
this
possibility.
This isn't working. Not,
in the same breath, this isn't working, can reveal there's a better way.
Yeah. So, and sometimes we have to literally get to those points where we feel that there is no way forward, there is no other option. We have to be faced with that reality for the real opening to come about.
Well, all the fears,
because all our strategies, to finish that, it's like all our strategies have run out their road.
Mm.
And it's only until that point comes that often we can see that which is not about strategy, that which is prior to strategy, that which is beyond all strategies.
That's the beautiful thing about awakening, is that despite the fear and the threshold of fear that one must often at some point go through.
I kind of stand by that at some point everyone hits into that threshold.
Like I hit
in their own flavor, for sure, but
I hit a thresh that what I would call, I think it's a thing. I think it's a necessary event, a necessary part. I hit that threshold of fear about a year before I actually woke up.
Yeah.
But it was very, it was like, oof, yeah. You know.
And some can meet that multiple times, actually. Yes, I would
exactly,
say.
And pull back and... Or it's not ready yet, it's not ready yet. Or some can be right at the point of awakening, threshold of fear, that's gone through and then ping, awoke. But it was a year after that I'd already gone through that threshold of fear. And actually some can do it after awakening.
I was literally about to say that. I think actually I did. That was, if I look at my experience, as you were just saying that, I was literally going to say that because I'm like, actually, I went through that post-awakening.
Yeah.
And actually, I would say I've been through that multiple times post-awakening in different ways.
Sure.
Because I think for me anyway, because there was so much trauma in my system, there had to be a structure, a strategy, a coping mechanism to not meet that. And so when that broke open with awakening, that was the... I couldn't meet fear until that point, not truly.
Right. And then it was just in your face without any possible strategies to avoid it.
Yeah.
You where the storm comes through full power with no...
Yeah.
Yeah, no hiding
but
from it.
That can happen prior to awakening for plenty of people. It does often.
Yeah.
I would say more often than not, it's
right. Well, I think it's both because, you know, it is, you know, you're not even going to be able to approach... awakening, as we talked about earlier, you know, you can't, if that fear on an individual level, if that fear when it arises, and obviously there's a lot of this about, again, post or pre, if that fear arises and you take that, interpret that as, oh, there is actual danger,
stop. Turn around.
If you
direction.
Take it as a signal
that
it means, so it's an interpretation, that means that there's a, I'm not going to go there because fear is telling me that this is really bad. It's the interpretation of fear as a go the other way.
Yeah. And I think if you have a lot of fear in your system, you're going to get to those signals before you get to the true existential fear. So you're going to be turning back the other direction sooner.
But in the end, your growth requires you at some point to go through it, because the fear, if it repeat, and it does in life, it can repeatedly stall you and set you back and set you back and set you back, stop you from, what was that phrase? What you want is beyond is the other side of fear. There's something really profound in that. I mean, I experienced that in my own life.
I think, you know, one of the biggest lessons I learned in life, I can't even remember where I learned this from. Actually, was this recognition of courage isn't the lack of fear.
Mm.
It's the opening up and moving forward even in amongst the fear. And that's where courage is.
Exactly.
It's not about not having fear.
Yeah, it's what you do with it.
Yeah. Because, I mean, like you talk about satsang, I that's still my experience very much. The difference is I've learned how to be with fear, how to open up and soften and hold, tenderly hold that fear, not as anything to be fixed or gotten rid of, but like, actually that it's just, to me, it's just that signal of life of like hitting into an edge and actually moving beyond. That edge is a false edge.
Yeah.
And it's moving beyond those edges. And often we have to do that in a very tender manner because there is fear there. And if it's not done in a tender manner, that can be very traumatizing. And actually, so learning how to be tender and holding of the experience of fear, the entire experience, whether that is mind, body, or energetic, or, you know, all of that, how to be with fear has really... shown me that fear is just our edge, temporary, false, one would say, but feels current.
Well, what does someone say? You know, there's no growth without no growth without pain. Yeah, it's the edge of your comfort, familiarity. Yeah. You're heading into uncharted territory.
And I would say living from in and as our true nature is constantly living on the edge, constantly moving beyond what is thought to be known and into the unknown. It's I just look at my life now. It's like it's a constant living. It's like you're living on that knife edge of the known and the unknown.
Yeah, I wrote that some piece of the final line. It was a piece called "We Don't Know." It was like, we just don't know what's coming. So we live in a state of actual not knowing. Yeah. We don't know what the next second was going to be. We just don't. No. We think we do, and we can comfort ourselves with predictions and statistical probabilities and whatnot, but we just literally don't know what's going to happen next. And the image was, we're standing on a prow of a ship in the deep ocean heading into uncharted territories with the water spray and the wind blowing in our faces. That's our reality. We just don't know. And that can be quite heady.
Yeah. Heady if you're expecting something else. If you're not expecting it, it's very... I mean, if you are expecting it, sorry, as in you have lived that reality, there's a great sense of liberation in that, a great sense of vastness, a great sense of freedom.
Well, I think it's discovering... Here's the difference between the ego and, you know, big self. That if you're egoic, you are genuinely feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're the big self, even the vulnerable ego is set against that, nested yes within this great freedom.
Yeah, and there's where the liberation is. It's like the truth of who I am, what I am, is not vulnerable in terms of needing to be secure and strong and put together. Is the truth of who I am is breaking open to each and every moment, and that to an ego seems vulnerable, but to your true nature is known as strength beyond strength. Even it's not about keeping hold of something or being something. It's about when you are nothing, you are everything.
Yeah, this discovery, that's really what so much of this comes to. That the whole reason we're just here week on week talking about what are we talking about? It is about discovering your deep, boundless nature that's ever present already. And there's so many ways we can approach it. And there's so many aspects to what life is, and the considerations of what it is to come to this, and then what it is to live in this and as this.
The realities of that,
You know, but ultimately, all we're really talking about is discovering your true nature.
Yeah.
Which is right here, right now, always present. But that actually requires so much sometimes.
Yes. I mean, it requires so much to be cracked open and broken. Like the structures of the beliefs that say you're not that is what has to be broken open.
Well, even to consider that there's a that to imagine or find that you are. I mean, you speak to most people who haven't got to a sort of a spiritual, even the beginnings of a spiritual understanding or insight or intuition, the idea that you're anything other than the body is just not even considered at all.
No.
So, you know, the trap of that is that there's a lack of imagination or sense of possibility. It's only later that insight that, not this body mind?
Yeah, but I think that insight, that question comes about when there has already been a glimpse of it.
Right, so it's grace that brings the glimpse, the intuition, maybe this the clouds part for a moment.
It's a slight sideways step, but I just want to...
Yeah, go.
We were going for a walk and we stopped to have lunch at a pub in Bosch. And we ran into that a guy who was talking in that pub, and he'd had an encounter with God.
I think. Well, I don't know. Can't remember quite what was his. He was Christian, right?
Yeah. And so he then,
because we were talking loudly, like having one of these conversations between as ourselves, as we do. And he said, "I can tell you this. I had this experience." Yes. And his interpret, I don't know where you're going with this, but
and where you're about to go. Yes, I think so.
Oh, so he was. He clearly has. We could sense it. So. Is authentic. Authentically, he had had a spiritual opening.
Yeah.
But then you could see that his interpretation of that experience was very. It was a very particular Christian viewpoint.
Yeah.
That was the framework that he could use in order to make sense of what he'd experienced.
Exactly. I guess my point being, the glimpse preceded any framework and any interpretation and conclusions that he had then drawn from that. And I think that's my point there, is that we have these glimpses, whether we recognize them as that or not, we have these glimpses, and life sets us on a path of understanding those glimpses. And I don't mean understanding in the mind, but understanding
deeply. Yes.
I don't mean only understanding the mind. I mean,
how do you make sense of the ineffable?
Yeah, exactly.
And live with that. There's a couple of people spring to mind. One is an awakened friend, and the other, who teaches meditation now, and he had a near-death experience, and it was such a profound, incredible spiritual experience. So, you know, he tells his own story on his own, in his own platform, on his own way, but that was a huge spiritual experience and insight. And then he had to go, what the was that? It changed him for sure.
Yeah.
But there was more to go for him to deeply understand and then deepen into his own awakening. Wow.
We got Storm Agnes bearing down on us.
Lashing the plants in the garden.
Yes.
So that happened then. The other one I was thinking of was Wayne Lickerman. Mm. Who was a drug addict, alcoholic, self-confessed here. He's very much part of his story. And he had, I can't remember how his glimpse went, but one day he just couldn't get drunk anymore, no matter what he did. He just couldn't, no matter what he took, no matter what he did, just had no effect on him. And he was just a serious, like, cocaine and alcohol addict. And, like, grace just took the ability of him to, let's say, hide in this these substances and whatnot, and it bewildered him that this could even come about, but he saw the hand of grace in it. And then he studied around the plate, looked in different ways, eventually found himself in India at the feet of Ramesh Balsekar, by whose grace and in whose presence he awakened to the self. And
I mean, we can have these glimpses that aren't so overt as the examples we've used here. You know, people can have glimpses that
that
are so subtle and so unknown as such, as in they're not seen as glimpses. And it might just be a slight shift that leads you to pick up a book on meditation,
right,
or leads you to want to be, to be curious about, attending a meditation, class. Or
you find maybe a glimpse of a sense of quiet peace in you.
Yeah.
Something like that.
The clouds just parting enough.
Yeah.
And so people can have these large glimpses and they can have these small glimpses. Regardless, it is a glimpse of your nature.
It's also the hand of grace at work here, isn't it? It's always like it comes upon you.
Yeah.
But that's the story of this whole thing, isn't it? We talk about non-doership extensively.
Where but this is also why we've talked about, you know, awakening being a symptom,
yeah,
you know, of like the desire to meditate or to yeah. sit in satsang or inquiry or any of these things is a symptom of that of awakening. Of an
inner awakening. Yeah,
exactly. That yeah. awakening that has already been, it's like the fuse has already been lit.
I mean, I've been saying this for years. This was my kind of whole thing, that idea that, you know, meditating, self-inquiry, going into satsang, spiritual inclination generally, it's a symptom of awakening, not a cause of. Because I was around a lot of meditators whose worldview was, we are meditating and they're bringing about world peace, or we're bringing about our own evolution. I was going, no, your meditation is a symptom that, you know, what's prior? Consciousness is prior. So any... And actually, I'm yeah, really
claim.
Yeah, it's a claim. It's a personal. It's still a personal claim that meditation is doing something, mm-hmm. rather than is an effect of an inner movement of conscience. I see the thing there, but I'm actually, I love Augustine's thing. We've said this before. The outward sacrament is the sacrament is an outer sign of an inner grace. And I like that.
And actually, in mm-hmm. terms of the context that we've been talking about today, in terms of breakdown, that also could be said, is that the yeah. breakdown is a symptom
yeah.
of that inner grace revealing itself.
Because beyond the crisis, there's something waiting for you. You know, and the crisis is there, and the breakdown is there to reveal it. That's its purpose.
It's hard to trust when you're moving through that. It's very hard to trust, actually.
It's a tough one. You have to remember that you are in the spiritual realm here. You have to remember that we're talking about deep spiritual principles that are that by necessity recognizes that the totality of being in particular and in general is all the good, and it's all orchestrating for the awakening of souls.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it in terms of nature, and you see that principle of a tree, you know, bearing fruit and then dying off, you know, and all you see, if you just see that it had fruit and now it's dead, that's then you just looking at it from that perspective, you're missing the spring that comes after that. And so sometimes we're living in the depths of winter and we can't see what the spring is going to look like. As humans, we might be living in the depths of winter and all we see is death and destruction. And it's not to negate the fact that walking through that death and destruction can be incredibly difficult. It's heartbreaking, yeah. Absolutely heartbreaking. But it's to, in the broader perspective, and that broader perspective may be beyond a singular life for time in terms of a human lifespan, but it is to recognize that death brings about rebirth, it brings about change, it brings about a transformation. And we often as humans look at those points of transformation in a very linear human fashion within the context of the relative. And yet what you and I are talking about here is the spiritual principles of life. And those transcend, yet include, but transcend and go beyond just the human temporary perspective of life. And so while it may feel like we are in a season of winter, that spring always comes after winter, and it reminds me of like the darkest time and nighttime is just before the dawn. And it's hard to see that perspective when you're in the darkest point of the nighttime. And so I want to just bring that forth a little bit, that it's not to negate the feeling of that darkness, but it is to say that from that death, from that destruction, from that darkness, there's where the light is found, and the rebirth into that light is found.
I like what you said, the broad perspective. And my instinct was like, yes, to identify. We have narrow perspectives on stuff, and we isolate. So life and death is a particular thing, is a particular view of it. and we say, oh, this tree lives and dies, or this person lives and dies, and so the life and death, and we're so caught up in individuals and in the view, and we completely miss the holistic view of being itself as a wholeness, and how, and through space and time, there's nothing that's disconnected from anything else, and it's
from that wholeness. It is the wholeness.
It's one field of being, and the only life it really is consciousness itself that that expresses through this. So even
in different manners, so which even is what as we
an individual form, you know, rises and falls, and the wholeness is never touched by it. It's never. It's always aliveness, expressing, rising and falling with individual aspects, and so it's funny coming to this awakening. You one has a different relationship to death, actually.
Really, really does. Yeah, really.
Or what appears to be death.
Yeah, just to see things from this individual perspective. For me is to miss so much of what life is, actually. And from this individual perspective, yes, we can be going through these seemingly deep, dark experiences, and literally death as well, bodily death, these kind of things.
Because I don't see in my own experience intuitively and actually at all sorts of levels. I mean, sure, there's the sense that I'm, you know, showing up or inhabiting a body that's certainly vulnerable, and who likes pain? No one wants pain. But it's not who I am.
No.
It's certainly a temporary expression of who I am, but I'm aware of all the changes and all the different things, and I'm aware that one day this body will just stop. But I am. It's so known as my very being.
Yeah.
And so so much as I still protect the body and look after and respond to, you know, threat or all this kind of stuff, my deep sense of myself is that I am beyond this. Now I am not this body as such.
And we are caretakers of this body in the same way we are caretakers of this this planet.
And it will have its time.
This life.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll have its time and then it'll pass, but I remain.
Yeah. And this experience of humanness is the vehicle by which I grow and expand and learn and evolve.
And it's sacred. I use this word often, and I think it's important. And that's why we've touched upon at times. Last week we were talking about the traditions that sort of see our human life as a problem to be solved, and I think there's a risk there that we miss that this human body is a sacred
vessel.
A sacred expression and vehicle of the spirit that we are.
Exactly.
And sure, when this body passes, I still am spirit, I still am consciousness, but I'm not going to. There's a sense of sacredness. There's a sense of honoring the body mind as it's functioning and living in accord with the truth that permeates from let's say the foundation up and through, and how we act and how we relate.
Yeah. Just because it's fleeting.
Yes.
Some people take that as in the nihilistic sense of, well, what's the point?
It's meaningless.
Yeah. For me, I take it exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is fleeting. Mm. The rose, as it buds and flowers, it is fleeting. For me, this is the opportunity to smell that rose so deeply and take in the fragrance of that.
And to let it pass.
Yes.
It's both and.
It is indeed. And so that is what makes this life sacred to me even more so, is the recognition that it is so fleeting.
Yeah. This is how the divine shows up in this, in this constant, you know, this light show, this multi-sensory kaleidoscopic light show.
It didn't make a mistake. It brought everything to bear in this moment. This moment is born of the divine for the divine and dies back to the divine.
Yeah. Yeah. While never never changing in itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a question was asked, I can't remember who it was, of some spiritual teacher, and said, well, if it's all, if consciousness or spirit is perfect in itself, in its perfect stillness, the question was, Why would anything come about?
Why bother?
Why bother? And the answer was something like the sheer bliss of being.
Yeah.
And that this analogy of you can be in a warm bath, and if you're perfectly still, you don't really feel the water, but you start to wriggle your toes, and you start to, it starts to be, you know, joyful and blissful, and
the movement bliss, of life,
bliss turns to blissful, and so life bubbles up in joy, and that's the thing, love and bliss. It's like it exists because, in a sense, well, what have some said the leela of being, which is to say the sportive play of the divine, simply because of the joy of manifestation. It's function of our very nature that we want to play in relativity, even while remaining as our boundless nature.
Yeah, it's that play, is that movement of life, and that movement of life is love.
Yeah.
It's like consciousness at play is love.
Yeah.
We are that.
We are that. Okay, I think we're gonna leave it there.
Yes. Thank you for listening this week. We really appreciate you, and love to share in this way with you.
Yeah. If you'd like to subscribe, please subscribe. If you'd like to share, if you feel that you'd like to share this with someone, please do that too, if you like, as you like. We'll be back.
Hopefully next week.
Yes.
We aim to
kind of put it out weekly, but it doesn't always work that way, so.
Life sometimes has other plans.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks everyone. See you next time.